Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Jennifer Ashley Tepper about her book, The Untold Stories of Broadway. We also chat separately with Seth Rudetsky and Jack Plotnick about their musical Disaster. Those interviews plus some news coming up on Broadway Radio. So please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio, this week on Broadway for Sunday, December 1st, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this afternoon, we have Michael Portantier. Peter is off at rehearsal for his new show, which we chatted about last week, Adam's Gifts. So Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
All righty. So we have a handful of things to get to this morning, so let's jump in right away. With us this morning, we have a special guest, Jennifer Ashley Tepper. Just going to give you a rundown of Jennifer's stuff. Jennifer is a musical theater historian and producer and has worked on Broadway shows including Title of Show, Godspell, The Performers, and Macbeth. She's the co-creator and writer of the Bistro Award-winning concert series, If It Only Even Runs a Minute, which celebrates the underappreciated musicals. In addition, Tepper is the managing editor of the Best Plays Theater Yearbook. Other credits and projects with shows include Ars Nova, NAMT, The Producing Office, PBS, the Rodgers and Hammerstein Organization, NYMPH, Second Stage Theater Company, the York Theater, and American Theater Wing's the Tony Awards. Tepper collaborates often with the group known as Joe Iconis and Family, and she is currently director of programming at 54 Below. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, thank you for cutting out time on your busy schedule. We are recording on Sunday morning after Thanksgiving. Are you traveling?
No, I'm not. I'm actually back in New York. Are you traveling?
No, we're comfortably back in our warm abodes. Michael, you're warm, right?
Yes, but yesterday I went to Staten Island and then I went to Astoria, so I was really traveling.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the Thanksgiving, you know, jaunt is from around the city to other parts of the city.
Right.
Well, good. So, Jen, tell us about your book. You know, you have a new book on the Dress Circle Publishing imprint. And I thought that it would be a lot of fun to talk with folks about what it is.
Sure. So the book is called The Untold Stories of Broadway. It came out on November 12th, and it's been very exciting to have people reading it and all of that. It's basically, I interviewed about 204 Broadway professionals, actors, directors, producers, and then also people that might not get interviewed as often, stagehands, musicians, doormen, company managers, press agents, you know, all of ushers, mm-hmm. Basically anyone who makes, you know, a living on Broadway, makes Broadway theaters their home. And it's every chapter in the book is a different Broadway theater. And then I kind of take you through the years in that theater and people's personal stories combined with my stories and discoveries about the theaters in between, kind of tell you about all the shows and all the people that have played there. So the book is, you know, it's a lot about the Broadway theaters themselves in terms of, you know, there's a chapter on the Richard Rodgers, and you might hear about, you know, someone who worked there on Finian's Rainbow and someone who worked there on Chicago and then someone who worked there on In the Heights, but they're all telling a story about the same dressing room at the Richard Rodgers. So it's based on the Broadway theaters themselves, which was kind of, you know, I've always loved the theaters as well as the shows and the people. So, it's been so exciting. It's been such a cool project to work on, and I'm thrilled that it's finally out.
Well, I've always said that, and I'm sure Jen will attest to it, that one could do an entire book on only the reminiscences of the ushers.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
But on the other hand, it's, you know, I mean, it's pretty neat that you also got to talk to people like Hal Prince.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the ushers I talked to was actually tying it into Hal Prince was Sylvia Bailey, who has ushered every performance at Phantom of the Opera since it opened. And
Wow. She's
a super cool lady. She's, you know, in her 90s, and she comes in every day to the city. She ushers Phantom of the Opera. She has great stories. And, you know, it was just, I interviewed her at the basement of the Majestic. So it was very, you know, it was much, a lot of exploring these places with the people who have been there for so long and interviewing them in the places that they work was really cool too.
Yeah, the whole run of Phantom never missed anything. She must take some good vitamins.
So. I think so.
So, let's talk, you know, you had really interesting interviews as like the one you told. You also cornered hard to corner celebrities like a Jason Alexander you interviewed for The Rink. And, you know, how is it like to coordinate 204 different schedules? How long did this take you? Did it take you a year, 2 years?
You know, it's funny. I've had the idea for a lot longer than I've actually been working on it. It certainly was, the seeds have been planted, you know, for a very long time. A lot of getting the, you know, celebrities was just about, you know, I have a lot of connections in the Broadway community from shows that I've worked on and from being here, you know, working on theater. And a lot of it was just, you know, I am friends with a lot of people in the original cast of Merrily We Roll Along and have worked with them before. And they all said to Jason Alexander, you know, you have to do the interview for this book. She, you know, is great and knows what she's doing and loves Merrily We Roll Along. And he, of course, said yes, because those are his, you know, old friends. So a lot of it is, you know, as we know, the theater community is so tight knit. It's just about having someone that, you know, kind of vouches for you, which is really nice. I would say for, you know, these 200 plus interviews, I rarely spoke to an agent. I think I might have spoken to an agent maybe 3 times, and it was all just direct contact with people or someone connecting me to someone else, which is really, you know, cool and heartening. And a lot of it was connecting over Facebook and Twitter, of course, because, you know, those connect us these days.
Did you say exactly how long you worked on it? You mentioned that you had the idea a lot longer than you actually worked on it. How much time did you actually, from the point at which you said, I'm going to write this book until you actually finished it was?
Yeah, most of it was intensively concentrated in between, I would say, like the beginning of this year and when the book was due, right before it came out in November. So most of it happened this year. So actually, you know, it all happened in a little less than a year, I would say.
Did you start to write the book before you had a publisher, or did you write the book first and then shop it?
No, I pitched this idea to Dress Circle Publishing, and Brisa and Roberto were just as excited as I was about the idea. And then I kind of started collecting interviews and writing the book. But it's funny. I mean, a lot of it feels like it was written in my head. Of course, authors probably feel like that all the time before it was actually written. But I pitched it to them, and then we all moved forward with it.
So this is one of the first releases by Dress Circle Publishing. Is that's true, right?
Yes, yes. They have a couple of books that came before that are great and have done really well, but they're theater fiction books.
Uh-huh.
And then they have a bunch of books coming out very soon that are going to be really funny and great.
So tell us, who was the most challenging, interview that you had for this book?
You know, certainly I was, you know, intimidated by some people just because how cool and how great to interview these theater legends. But really I think the most challenging interviews were, I think, times where people have been interviewed so much and had been asked so many questions already.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to ask them, you know, of course you want to ask Hal Prince about Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, but of course you've read 10 interviews and 3 books where he talks about it already. So getting stories about those things while still coming up with something original to say about them was definitely a challenge. It was a good challenge. People like Charles Strauss, who also, of course, tons of interviews, tons of, you know, books. It was a challenge to come up with those original questions, but I think I feel good about how it went.
My Hal Prince story is years ago. I interviewed him and, Jen, are you familiar with the musical Rosa?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. It really had a very short run. But I really liked it. And I'll never forget when I interviewed him, I said, I guess we were just talking about, you know, people's reactions to things and reviews, as you know, and reviews, how a show is reviewed and how it's received by the critics as opposed to the public and blah, blah, blah. And I said something like, well, what would you say if I told you that I enjoyed Rosa more than Phantom of the Opera? And he said, well, he said, you know, if that's you, if that's what you think, then that's your reality. And it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks.
Of course, yeah. I bet he actually, you know, loved that. I think Rose was very close to his heart. We talked about it a little bit as well.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah. And I really I hope that show gets another chance someday.
I bet it will. It's got a good score. It's actually, you know,
it does.
It's a really interesting show. Yeah.
Many Broadway fans have never actually been in the Mark Hellinger because there isn't a church there now. But you interviewed a handful of folks there, and your story with Lonnie Price about the Hellinger was very interesting. How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely wanted to include one lost theater in the book, or a theater that was either demolished or no longer. And of course, the Hellinger is the time for a church. So, I was fascinated by the stories about the Hellinger, and it struck me that because it closed to, you know, Broadway in 1989, there were certainly a lot less people to talk to about it, which is very sad. Lonnie's story, I had heard, you know, vaguely, not any details, about how the cast of Rags, which played even shorter than Rosa, it was four performances, how when they got their closing notice, they marched on Times Square to kind of sell tickets and also just, you know, tell people the show was happening, and the entire audience marched with them. So Lonnie actually led that, and I didn't really know the full story at all. And he made a speech at the curtain call of the second to last show. They marched on Times Square. It's kind of a great story about, you know, exactly what can only happen on Broadway, that live audience and, you know, the actors all coming together and doing something like yelling in the middle of PKTS about Rags. So that was definitely a great story. He also talks about how all he wanted was, you know, to be on Broadway and to be in Rags and have this happen. But if the show had gone on and not played four performances, he wouldn't have done Dirty Dancing. And he ended up being really glad, of course, that he did that movie. So there's a lot of, you know, details about people's lives and, you know, sliding glass doors type of moments that are chronicled in the book of what could have happened and what did happen.
So these are just such a great collection of stories, and they're so readable because, you know, it's a book that you can pick up and read a chapter or two, then put down and pick it up again. It's not the type of thing where you have to make a huge time commitment, although I picked it up and I couldn't put it down. So it's it fits very well in a stocking, doesn't it, Jennifer?
Yes, of course. It's very small for a stocking. Yeah, I love that about it. People have been telling me, you know, Steve Rosen, who's in the book, has been saying it's great bathroom reading, which made me laugh. You know, you can definitely read it out of order. You can pick it up and read a story and flip through and find someone you want to read. And it's also great if you read it in order. So it works either way. And I kind of love that.
Especially if you're going to head out to see a show, say, you know, I'm going to go see Big Fish at the Neil Simon, you can pick it up and grab a little history for 15 to 20 minutes before you run out the door. It's a lot of fun. It's a really good, and you can get it nearly everywhere. Isn't that true?
Yes, you can get it lots of places. You can get it on Amazon.com, and it's also available on Kindle now, which I'm eager to tell people. I like myself a hardcover book, but I mean like a hard copy, but a lot of people like to read it on Kindle.
So let's shift gears for a second and talk a little bit about 54 Below and what's going on there. So
sure.
Are you 3 months or so into your job, or is it longer than that?
It's a little. I started around August, so I'm in it now.
Yeah,
it's been a couple months.
And tell us how, you know, what is the reality versus what you thought it was going to be? Every job has got that. Oh, I think the job is going to be this, and then it turns out to be, you know, so much so different and a lot of fun in either direction. But tell us what it's like to be the director of programming at 54 Below.
Sure. You know, it's so exciting. It's kind of, I'm so happy there. I love it. I love being the director of programming there. You know, we do 18 shows a week, which of course, you know, is a lot. So a lot of nights we'll have a 7 p.m., a 9:30 p.m., and 11:30 p.m. Most nights, that's what we have. And I think, although I certainly knew it before I was going in, you know, now that I'm director of programming, most of what you see on our stage is my responsibility to get it up there. And I think the thing that's been most surprising and wonderful is that before I started the job, I would be there, you know, to produce a concert, or I would be there to see one thing. But if you're there working there and you're there a lot, you get to see that the Broadway community is so many different pockets that intersect in so many cool ways. You know, like there will be nights where we'll have, you know, at 7 p.m. we'll have Anne Hampton Calloway. And then at 9:30 p.m. we'll have someone who's more of, you know, an emerging writer or an emerging Broadway performer. And then at 11:30 you have people who are coming after their shows to sing, who are currently on Broadway. So it's kind of, it's this huge, like it runs the gamut between people who are very established, people who are emerging, people who have been on Broadway for, you know, a long time, people who haven't been on Broadway. We have like songwriter nights, just a variety of people that, you know, are under the umbrella of like, you know, a Broadway supper club. It's really, if you sit there for a full night, you just get such a, you know, variety of different kinds of acts and songs and artists. So.
And isn't it always amazing? But it's always amazing who knows who else, you know, like who you would think have no connection to each other, you know, oh, hi, you know, and they fall into each other's arms. It's amazing.
Absolutely. It's the great fun of it is that, you know, there are always people there, you know, and there are always people, you know, getting introduced, and it's a lot of fun. It's just like a constant Broadway party. You know, we had Don't Quit Your Night Job last week, and it literally was, you know, the room was packed, oversold. And at least half the audience was people that are Broadway actors or like Broadway directors, writers. So it's really fun there all the time. And I really love being there.
Do you find that this happens to, you know, money people and Broadway producers and things like that, that everywhere they turn, they get pitched a new project now? Now, every time you go out, you're at, you know, Shake Shack or something like that, they're like, oh, Jennifer, I want to tell you about my new show, you know?
You know, it does happen a lot. I think it's so great. Like, I love more than anything, clearly, you can tell from my book, that the Broadway community is so concentrated in these 15 blocks. But if you are in these 15 blocks, that will happen. It's great. Yeah.
I'm going to be seeing Daniel Ricard's Christmas show coming up there. That I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be great. Yeah, we have so much Christmas stuff going on, which, you know, I love Christmas, especially being a Jew that doesn't quite get to, like, celebrate it. So it's going to be so fun to celebrate so much Christmas all month.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning and telling us about your book and 54 Below. We're really excited, you know, as we've said here before, that we talk about you very often here on the broadcast, because we're excited to see all the things that you're doing, and please come back and visit us again.
Well, thank you so much. That's so nice. And thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care.
Great. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. Michael, can you imagine, you know, being Jen Tepper and, you know, her second book, you know, she in between 18 shows a week at 54 Below, in between all those shows, she's writing down little notes to herself about things for her next book, her next projects and things like that. She's very, very busy. And
well, aside from everything else, I just think it's so great that people of her age, can be so enthusiastic and so knowledgeable at that age, even, you know, about theater. It's good to know, because sometimes we feel like that. I mean, obviously there are young people who are into theater, but I sometimes wonder how many of them are really that appreciative and knowledgeable of the history of it. And she certainly is.
Oh, she totally
is. Yeah, certainly is. So that really does my heart really real good.
So, Michael, you know how the History Channel has Shark Week and Nazi Week and all these other weeks that we have?
Yes.
We have Musical Theater Nerd Week, and we're going to have a second interview. So our second interview is with Seth Rudetsky and Jack Plotnick. With us this morning, we have Seth Rudetsky and Jack Plotnick, who are the creators of Disaster, a 70s disaster movie musical, which is now playing off-Broadway at the St. Luke's Theater at 308 West 46th Street. So good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing?
quote unquote, it's all good.
Why the quotes? Can't it just all be good?
Okay, it's all good. Next question. How are you?
Perfect.
Well, let's identify everybody. So so that was Seth at first, and then Jack jumped in second, so that our listeners are not quite as confused as they possibly would be. But
the nasal voice is Seth. The lady voice is Jack.
Yeah. Oh. Or I could do like a British accent. Would that help?
Please cut the interview short. Please end the interview. Hello.
So, guys, tell us about Disaster and how it came to be. Seth, why don't you start us off there?
Okay. I was doing a show called Forever Plaid with my friend Drew Geraci, and we used to joke about, you know, we were obsessed with disaster movies, and we said, oh, wouldn't it be funny to do a disaster movie as a musical, but do a disaster that hasn't ever been in a movie? And I said, oh, my God, what about the blackout of 1977, which I thought would be really funny because it's so not, it's like not really interesting in a movie. So we said, oh, we'd make a stage version of that about the blackout, and I said we'd use all 70s music. And we'd always kind of joke about it, and I think the only joke we came up with was, well, two things. Like, someone had to come over to someone's apartment, and it was like, you can ring my bell. Like, that was one joke. And the other one was, like, when there's a lot of looting going on, someone was going to sing, everybody was kung fu fighting. And that's kind of all that happened for 20 years. And I was going, God, I was like, I really think it could be a really fun musical, but nothing happened. And then, like, a lot of years passed, and this great organization called Only Make Believe, which brings theater to hospitalized kids, asked me to do a benefit because I'd done a lot of work for them. And I was like, you know what? This would really force me to write the show. So I was in Palm Desert at the time with Jack. And Jack thought it was a great idea. And I said, you know, instead of a blackout, I said, why don't we do every single disaster, like an earthquake and a tidal wave and killer bees. And Jack was like, oh, my God, what a great idea. He said, when is the show? And I said, in 2 months. And Jack's like, how much have you written? I'm like, no, it's in 2 months. I have a fun idea. Jack said, you haven't written any. He was infuriated at me. So he literally opened up my laptop, and he was like, start writing. And he was like, scene one. So Jack and I wound up writing it together in around 2 months. And then we did the first benefit. And Jack, you want to take over?
And then the first benefit went fantastically. And we really felt like we had something terrific, and we continued working on it. We did a smaller production at the Triad about a year and a half ago, and that went so well, and we got this, I don't know who invited them, but we got this crazy rave review from the Times. And so Seth and I just decided to self-produce the show off Broadway, and we raised the money, and we continued working on it, and we're just super happy and thrilled with where the show is, how it is, and the cast we got is insane.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. We got these like amazing Broadway people to work at this little off-Broadway theater for like not even off-Broadway wages, for essentially no wages. And we really got this amazing, that is the most shocking thing, is the amazing cast that we got, I have to say. So I agree with Jack. The cast is amazing.
Well, I saw it at the Triad, and it totally deserved whatever rave reviews it got, because it was so fantastic. And what's amazing to me is that aside from everything else, that you've got not one, because it's two different people, right, in that production and this one playing the young person the twins. I don't want to say too much, but there is a person who plays male and female twins, and it's just beyond brilliant.
We really lucked out with that. You know, it's funny. It's like, you know, the first kid that we got to play the part, he was a 13-year-old kid, and he was maybe one of like six recommended, and he was amazing. And then apparently something is called puberty. And when we did it a year later, he came in for the role of Old Man River, Old Man River. So he couldn't do the role anymore. And Jack and I were auditioning all these kids, and we really couldn't find anybody. And it's the magic of the internet. I put a tweet out just saying, you know, can any kid out there sing really well with vibrato? Because everyone was doing that Billy Elliot, like, la, like weird straight tone voice. I'm like, can you sing, please? Because, like, can anybody sing? And this kid, like, sent me a video from like his email account, and his name is Jonah Verdon, and he was wearing like a cast on his arm, and he was like, I want to be in Disaster. As you can see, I've had my own biking disaster, because his arm was in a cast. And then he sang a little bit, and immediately I was like, this is a kid. And I called him back, and it was a weird area code, and his mom answered. I was like, well, where do you guys live? And she's like, Atlanta. And I was like, well, the show's in New York. She's like, that's fine. I was like, it's in 2 weeks. Literally. And she goes, his father's brother lives in Brooklyn. I go, right, but it's in 2 weeks, and he's in school. She's like, he's homeschooled. So he just came in the audition, and he and his mom moved to New York, and they live here. And, I mean, it's one of those curses, because he is so amazing that every single review essentially does not mention me, and it's a lot of like, Jonah Verdon is brilliant. Seth Rogensky is also in the cast. Like, wait, but I have a bigger part. Anyway.
That reminds me of when Charles Bush did MAME. He played MAME, and in one production he had, I think it was his nephew or something playing young Patrick, and he got all the reviews, and Charles's remark was, I wish everybody would stop talking about the kid.
Yes, 100%. I'm writing that roll out when he transfer to Broadway.
It never work with monkeys or children. Yeah, it's a problem. But the kid is brilliant. It was like, I barely had to direct him. He just is brilliant. Whereas Seth, it was a constant, no, I'm just kidding.
Constant struggle for Jack to direct me and rein me in.
Now, Jack, you have stepped into the role of Tony, isn't that true?
Yes, it's just such crazy fortune, because the actor playing Tony, who was brilliant, had to take a month off to do Oliver at Paper Mill, and I just thought, wow, like this just felt like it was just this gift from the heavens to actually switch places and actually be in front of the lights, and I'm having the best time. It's a very strange sensation, because it was not planned, but I love playing Tony, and it was sort of the one role I could play, and so...
Because Jack lives in L.A., so it's like, it wasn't likely that he was going to take over, but I forced him to move to New York for 1 month to do the part. You know, that's why it was such a big deal, because if he lived in New York, we would have somehow done the show together for the whole time, but he lived in L.A., but... What website? He went on some weird website and got an apartment for a month, and that's how the whole thing happened.
I
wanted to ask you guys directly. The show has about, it seems like it has 100 songs from the 70s, from the cheesiest ones to the really good ones. But I noticed that it does not have the disaster movie songs. Was that, did you just think it would be too obvious? Did you have problems with the rights?
No, it's just like, you know, it's so funny. People say that to us. I'm like, well, what would the joke be? I'm like, if the song is already in a disaster movie, the whole point of this show is that all the songs have double meanings, that every lyric has another meaning to it, and that's why the audience is, I mean, seems to appreciate it so much that, you know, I don't want to give away any jokes, but every lyric in the show relates so clearly to the story, and a lot of times it's twisting what the words mean. Right. So if already there was a song in a disaster movie that was the thing for the disaster movie, I feel like it's very on the nose, and it would just be like a very serious disaster movie musical instead of being a comedy. So that was the main reason why we didn't use any. We didn't know what the actual joke would be there for.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you had used something like The Morning After or We May Never Love Like This Again, I guess it would have to be in a different context, or maybe you would just have like somebody like whistling it, you know.
We didn't do many like... We wanted to write the show so anybody would enjoy it, so that there was never a moment of somebody laughing and someone going, why are you laughing? So it's really, we really wrote it to use the archetypal characters from disaster movies, but not to be a spoof of a certain moment in a disaster movie.
Exactly. So
we have one big wink to Poseidon Adventure, because, well, you just have to, because for me, that's the disaster movie.
Yeah, because for Sound Adventure, just FYI, people don't know it. That was really the one disaster movie that was about a really exciting disaster, and the characters really had depth and a real journey. And the other ones just kind of became to be about the disasters, and they just were almost just the characters didn't matter. But Poseidon Adventure was a real dramatic movie, and that's what we really strove to have with Disaster 2, that even though we are going for comedy and we are going for the fun disasters, we really wanted to give every single character an actual real dramatic arc and end the show with some heart and with some actual depth. So... anyway, I guess what Jack is also saying, we're both saying we didn't want it to be a parody. We wanted it to be an actual standalone musical and a tip of the hat to disaster movies.
There are so many great setups in it, but I think the one that stands out for me is the way you set up Hooked on a Feeling.
Oh, thank you. You know, I have to say, it's so funny when you see that, because almost like, you know, it's funny, Jack and I go back and forth trying to remember what songs we picked, but I picked a lot of the songs because I was obsessed with 70s music. And really almost every song on the show was just me at the gym with my iPad on, or iPod, which one is it? But the point is, going, oh my God, I want to have this song on the show because I love it so much. And then when I would think that, I would think, how could I get it into the plot? So Hooked on a Feeling was just a song that I love because I think it's so joyous. you know, and then I was like, oh, here's how it related to the plot. But it wasn't like I thought of a plot point and then I put that song in. So I'm glad you like it because I'm obsessed with that song. I really wanted it to be in the show.
I said on the podcast a week or two ago, and honestly, all kidding aside, I really think this show should go to Broadway.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
Oh, God. I think it would be. I said it's the show Mamma Mia wishes it was. And I know, don't you always say that Mamma Mia gives you a headache? Isn't that what
Mamma Mia, you know, it's so funny. People think I hate Mamma Mia because I think it's a bad show. I hate Mamma Mia because it's a 9-person band in the theater where West Side Story was, where they had a 35-piece orchestra. And they came over, they got a dispensation from the union to allow a 9-person band to be one of the top money-making shows in the world. And on top of that, the show is lip-syncing. That's what I hate about Mamma Mia, is that they're on Broadway and they're like a theme park, and no one is protesting the fact that it's pre-recorded saxophone parts. Literally, on the synthesizer, you play a middle C and the saxophone plays a pre-recorded ba-da-da-da-da. I mean, it's literally horrific British style of cutting the orchestra and lip syncing. That's what I hate about this show, just FYI. It's like, you know, I understand that it's a big hit, and I get that, and I get people love the music, and it's like a really fun story, but I don't think you're allowed to change Broadway and have lip syncing and completely cut the orchestra and make so much money. So that's my big objection. But back to Disaster being on Broadway. Please produce us. Call me later.
So, Seth,
we self-produce this ourselves, and we'll stay open until we run out of money, which could be tomorrow. But the reviews have been great, so we're selling pretty good. But we are in the market for anybody who wants to get involved in, and that would be a dream come true to be in any larger theater.
Oh my God!
I hope you have people coming down. I mean, I don't see how anyone could see that and not have. Just, I mean, aside from how great it is, not have dollar signs flash in their eyes. It's just so incredibly enjoyable and hilarious. And I, you know, I think there would be a market for that, and show people how, you know, a jukebox musical can really be done well.
I think the thing that makes me the thing that makes me the happiest, Michael, it's funny you say that, is that it reminds me of doing Forever Plaid in the sense that I've really seen how it appeals to all ages, because definitely it was a little part of me thinking, oh my God, you have to be exactly my age to appreciate this song or appreciate this joke. But I love the fact that, like, we've really had kids, like 10-year-olds, see the show more than once. Like, it literally appeals to so many different ages, and that's what makes it happen.
I think the reason why is because Seth and I, we love music theater. I mean, obviously everybody knows Seth really appreciates the form. And so we really approached writing the show as if we wanted to write the next, you know, we wanted to really pay homage to those brilliant musicals from like the 60s, the 70s, and the ones that really told a story, got you involved in characters, and made you care. And I remember there was a time when we were rehearsing, and one of the actresses, one of the characters dies, and she was kind of making a bit with it and being funny. And I said, you know, people are actually really going to care when you die. They're going to be sad. And she said, well, I'll try it. And it really is a joy every night to watch that moment, because people are laughing so hard, and then she dies, and it's just silence. And you literally
hear people like crying. And I think Jack is a real bravo, because as much as I love musical theater, I don't necessarily know the logistics of the form. And Jack went to Carnegie Mellon and took this course. And I remember him talking to me as we were writing the show, and he said in his course he learned you have to put the two lovers in Act 2, you have to put them up in a tree, and then you have to have people shooting at them. And I love that image. You have to keep them apart. And it was just really great, because it really helped the form of the show to go back to old forms and try to recreate that with this show. So, Rabbi Carnegie Mellon and Jack Plotnick.
Well, that's actually a screenwriting tool. But yes, there's a lot of rules to creating the engine of a show. And I am really proud of the engine we created, meaning just that the mechanics of the show run, and you get people involved, and you get them caring and cheering for your characters. So I'm thrilled with where we got with that. But thank you again for your compliment. It's really kind.
Thank you, Michael.
We should mention the amazing cast. We have, is it Farker or Farcher?
Farcher, who's literally 22 years old. I mean, the chutzpah. He's so crazy talented and gorgeous. And he came to an Equity just open call. And yet again, he's another Jonah Verdon. It's like I constantly reviews about him, and that always end with Seth Rudetsky is also in the cast. So anyway, bravo to Matt Farcher. I can't take it.
Oh, he was great. Yeah. And there again at the Triad, you had, I'm sorry, what is that fellow's
Zach
name?
Zach Resnick. You know, Zach Resnick and Felicia Finley were both at the Triad. The cast and director from Mamma Mia came. 2 seconds later, they're now both on Broadway and Mamma Mia. So
exactly.
They were snaps away from us.
let me just run down the other people, because really you have the greatest people in the show, and some of them we don't see that often. We have Rob Sapp. We have John Tracy Egan is the fellow who's currently doing Mr. Bumble in Oliver at Paper Mill. Haven Burton. Jennifer Simard, who is a forbidden Broadway veteran. She is the funniest woman on the face of this earth. She plays the sister in a total, well, deadpan in the beginning, but let's just say that it doesn't stay that way. Mary Testa is the Shelley Winters, sort
basically,
of.
Basically, yes. Tip of the hat to Shelley Winters, definitely.
Tom Reese Farrell, Charity Dawson, Michelle Ragusa, another one of my all-time favorites. Jonah Verdon, whom we've discussed, incredible. Saum Eskandani?
Yes, his first big New York show.
Shers Alataha?
We have two Persians in the cast. We have more Persians in the cast of Aladdin. That's what they said. They actually told me that. They said we have more than the actual cast. So, bravo.
And Maggie McDowell is rounds out the cast. And you have got to see this show. This playing schedule is a little tricky.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about that?
We're weekdays, basically. We're Monday, Tuesday, and Friday nights, and then we have a Wednesday matinee, too. That's the way we look at it. Monday, Tuesday, Friday nights, Wednesday, Monday. But just, go to the website and you'll see. And we could probably announce this also, because we're about to announce it. Michelle Ragusa has to take a leave of absence, too. So her part, we play kind of opposite each other. She plays the lounge singer that has the two twins. She's being replaced by the brilliant and hilarious Mary Birdsong.
Oh, great.
Yeah, Mary starred on Reno 911 and was in the movie The Descendants. And she's
in the Martin Short show. She's hilarious in the Martin Short show on Broadway.
She does a great Judy Garland.
Seth,
I've been teasing this that you guys are going to come on for the last couple of weeks. It's been hard with your schedule because you've been doing you're out of town so often.
Yeah.
But I was saying to folks that we were going to try to get you on a couple of weeks ago, but you were in New Orleans with Patti LuPone, and nothing good can come of that. So, but now I'm looking at your schedule. I guess tomorrow or. So tomorrow, Tuesday, you're in New Orleans again with Charles Bush?
When am I? No. You know what? I said no. It's so funny. We were supposed to be tonight in New Orleans, but it's like some horrible sports game, like whatever the horrible sports is down there, baseball, football, something's happening. So they had to move the date to Tuesday, and I was like, I'm Len Cario. I was like, my understudy is not going on. I was like, it's not happening. So Charles is doing the show with somebody else. I boycotted it. However, this Saturday, I'm in the Poconos with Audrey McDonald at the Stroudsmore Manor. So I am out of town Saturday. I only try to go out of town when I don't have disaster. Yeah. But it is hard for me to ever stay in town. You're right.
I should say about Seth's performance, if anybody loves Seth on the radio, you have to see this performance because it is not at all what you would expect. I love that Seth wrote this role. That it's a kind of humor I've never seen him do. It's sort of like a hysterical straight man. And it's very unexpected, and it's really good. And wanted to give a shout-out to that.
Yeah, I really wanted to do something different. I didn't want to always be the crazy, obsessed, wacky. So I wrote a role someone completely emotionally shut down.
And the way you find humor in that archetype of the disaster expert who is so focused on saving people is so surprising, Seth. I mean, I've just never seen that particular take on that character, and it's awesome.
I agree.
Thank you, Jack. I'll take it.
Now, Seth, you also have Gypsy of the Year coming up. You want to tell us maybe some of the...
Yes, I have to say I'm very excited about it. It's my sixth year hosting Gypsy of the Year. And Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, one of the people that worked there requested that I write the opening number. I used to write a lot of opening numbers and Dev Janke used to direct them. And then I kind of took a break when I started hosting. But anyway, he requested, he said, it's a special favor for the 25th anniversary, can I write it? So I wrote this opening number because Gypsy of the Year first happened at the theater where Gypsy was playing with Hein Daly. So they said, can you write something about Ethel Merman and Gypsy? So the whole opening number is going to feature Clea Blackhurst as Ethel Merman with the cast of Newsies. And I have to say, I'm very happy with a lot of the jokes in it. And some of them are very inside. Maybe you'll appreciate this. When she shows up, she says, she shows up to the theater and she goes, thank God I brought a winter coat. Call me Miss Birdseye. This show is freezing. Anybody? Okay. It's such an inside joke. But the point is, I'm really excited about the opening number. And then, you know, I'll be hosting and doing a lot of our own stick. And actually, Jack and I are going to do the disaster sketch. We're going to represent the show Disaster and do our own comedy during Gifts of the Year, too.
So it will be on Broadway. It'll be on Broadway very
exactly.
soon.
For 2 minutes. Wonderful.
So I back to your concert schedule there. You have Audra next week or the week after. But, I mean, this list of people, this Christine Ebersole, Megan Mullally, Megan Helty, Sutton Foster, Patti LuPone, Gita Rivera, Jane Krakowski. I mean, you're busy. How do you do all this stuff?
You know what? It's so hilarious people ask me that question. I'm like, how does anybody have a 9-to-5 job and have any other life? How do you wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning? Possibly, do you go to the gym ever? Like, I don't understand how anyone, to me, it's like, so what? It's like, I work for an hour and a half a day. Like, I do not think it's busy at all. I mean, I really am, like, not even joking. It's like, how do you get home from work at 6:30 and do anything with your life? Like, to me, like, this is the ultimate lifestyle. Like, an hour here, an hour there. Like, it's so fun. But I will just plug one thing. When you talk about all these amazing women, we've been filming all these concerts, and we have them now. You mentioned my website, Seth TV. We have on SethTV.com, we have a full hour and a half concert with Patti LuPone, a full with Megan Mullally, and just yesterday, the one with Sutton Foster was released. So if you don't live in my cities where I do these shows, you can always see them on Seth TV.
And Jack, on your side, Seth said he dragged you in from the left coast, but you have, is this an audition workshop that you do for folks, or is this coaching?
I run out of this. Jack has a brilliant acting class that he's been doing for years with crazy mega celebrities obsessed with it, and I will name drop Allison Hannigan, you know, from How I Met Your Mother, Andrea Martin. When I was doing Fairly Modern Millie, Sutton Foster literally had his website photocopied next to her mirror. Like, literally, he's brilliant. Let's go.
Oh, thank you. It's been a hobby of mine. I make my living, as an actor, but now also as a director. I directed a movie that I'm in post-production with right now. But this hobby is just so close to my heart, and that is helping actors to love acting. And when you love it, and you realize how fun and easy it can be, you actually book more work. And so I'm kind of the anti-acting teacher in a way, because I keep telling people, please get out of class. You're done. But the point is, I wrote a free online book that you can read at my website, jackplonick.com. And whenever I have the time, I do lectures and workshops on both coasts. And if you ever want to come to it, you just write to me on my website to get on the mailing list. I'm going to do a lecture probably in about a week here in New York.
It's so brilliant. And just to name drop one more thing, you know, Jack, I just did a movie. He literally wrote and directed a movie, and not high budget, and literally got the stars Liv Tyler, Patrick Wilson. I mean, it's crazily amazing. And Matt Bomer. Anyway, the point is, Jack's incredibly successful, and I could barely pay my rent. Next question.
Well, you know, I just don't know how to top that. I just
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Wow. Ouch.
So I want to remind our listeners that let's run down all these websites again. We're going to have them on our show notes at BroadwayRadio.com. So Jack Plotnick, PLOTNICK.com. Then Seth TV, SETH, the letter T, the letter V.com. And Disaster
Musical.com.
And thank you both so much for getting up on a Sunday morning to chat with us. This is
thank you. I hit church and then called you. What? I'm Jewish. Anyway, thank you, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Have a great one. Bye-bye.
Peace out.
Michael, I don't know. What do you think? I think, like, Seth is ready to run out the door and run a marathon. He just has so much energy.
Well, he's so multi-talented in so many different areas. I think he really is one of those geniuses. It's amazing that not only that he does so much, but he does it all so well. You know, I mean, you would think there would be a point of like spreading oneself thin, but I don't think he's reached that yet.
Yeah, but you know, I'm thinking maybe a switch to decaf, maybe halfway through the day. So, anyway, we had a week full of news, and in the news was an interesting story that Macbeth seemed to have not made it through a full performance. And Michael, you were there.
Yes, I was there. The show started and then it stopped about 20 minutes through, and the I assume the stage manager got on the God mic and said that we were having trouble with the scenery. We apologize. And we sat there for, I don't know, maybe about 5 minutes. And then actually he said, okay, we're good to go. And the lights went down again and the audience applauded. And then he said, oops, sorry. And I apparently there's this production has a lot of scenery that's supposed to come up out of the floor, et cetera. And they just felt that they could not continue without all of the mechanized stuff. It's interesting because there was a lighting problem recently at the other Shakespeare plays, the Mark Rylance productions of Twelfth Night and Richard III. But in that case, first of all, they have a unit set, because the productions are done, tried to be done in the very much in the style of the old Globe. And the lighting is very, very basic anyway. So they were able to continue at least two performances where the lights were not working correctly. But here, I guess, I think a lot of it was probably actors' safety, you know, and they probably could have continued the show if they had rehearsed, you know, around the scenery or with maybe people actually carrying it on. But you can't just do that, you know, on no notice. So anyway, yeah. It was canceled and we, you know, we were offered to come back again. But I'm really interested to see the rest of the show because it got quite negative reviews. And I must say that I will say that from what I saw and heard, I just don't think that Ethan Hawke's manner of speech is really appropriate for Shakespeare. He seems so contemporary to me. And also he has an S problem. I'm not sure what that's all about, but that was very distracting to me. And every time he spoke, it kind of took me out of the show. But the reason I wanted to go back and see the whole thing is that Jack O'Brien has a very interesting concept whereby the three witches in this production are played by men. And that's interesting in itself, but even more interesting is that they're really woven into the production in that they're playing other characters. And the idea being that the witches are very much a part of everything that happens in this tragedy and kind of, you know, kind of spurring on, you know, all of the evil things that are going to happen. So like, for example, right at the beginning, one of the witches turned out to be someone who was wounded in battle. And then right after that, another one of the witches was a messenger or something like that. You know, they're just playing the minor roles, but they all figure into the tragedy. And I really want to see how that plays out. I thought it was a very, very interesting concept.
So it's that's, you know, not the only thing that has been going on this week in the news. We also have James Franco is coming to Broadway, as was rumored back in, I guess, March or so.
Yes.
Mice and Men.
Yeah. Right before the Thanksgiving holiday, two really big pieces of news came in. James Franco is going to be playing George opposite Chris O'Dowd as Lenny in a Broadway revival of Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, set to begin performances at the Long Acre on March 19th and open on April 16th. And James Franco, I believe he was first rumored to be coming to Broadway in a production of Sweet Bird of Youth with Nicole Kidman. Anybody remember that?
Yeah.
And that didn't happen for whatever reason. I seem to think that his name was mentioned for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof after that, although I may just be being confused. But at any rate, he is doing Of Mice and Men, which I think is great because I don't know if I mentioned this before. I have seen several off Broadway productions of the play. And I think it's really quite a masterpiece that is not as famous as a stage piece as it should be. Maybe because the book itself is so famous. There have been several excellent movie versions of it. It really packs an amazing, amazing emotional wallop on stage when it's done well. And I'm so glad it's going to be coming back to Broadway I'm not sure. I didn't look up the history of the productions. I think I'm not sure if this is the first Broadway revival. I know there was one with James Earl Jones some years ago. I'm not sure if that was considered Broadway. I think it was at Circle in the Square. And I'm sorry, I didn't think to research all this. But, you know, you can all go to IBDB and look
it up. Seems like there has been, I guess the third production is the Longacre Revival coming up. The last production was at the Atkinson in 1974, and the first one was in 1937 at the Music Box. So 74 production had Pamela Blair, David Clark, Kevin Conway, Pat Corkley, David Gale, Stephen Grotsch, Mark Gordon, James Earl Jones. So yeah, that was the production you're talking about.
So it wasn't at Circle in the Square.
It was at Brooks Atkinson, unless there was some sort of benefit that was at Circle or something like that that you're thinking.
Well,
about.
Or maybe I just mixed
it. But this was 74-75 season, 61 performances, didn't last very long.
Mm. Or maybe it moved from Circle. We'll have to check. Anyway.
Yeah.
And then the other piece of news, which is not unexpected, is that Bryan Cranston, who is just known to millions for his work on Breaking Bad on TV, is coming to Broadway with a show that he just recently did up at ART in Cambridge, which is becoming like the major supplier of Broadway lately. And not only supplier of Broadway, but supplier of Broadway hits. The Pippin revival started there, and the Glass Menagerie, the amazing Glass Menagerie, the current revival started there too. And I think there's another one that I can't. Oh, Porgy and Bess before that. This is a play called All the Way by Robert Schenken, and it's about Lyndon Johnson, the president. And let's see, I made a bookmark here. It's also going to have Michael McKean and Brandon J. Dearden continuing in the roles of respectively of J. Edgar Hoover and Martin Luther King. It's not a one man show, obviously, by any means. I checked the cast list and it's got a fairly large cast. So that sounds like that's going to be something to really mark your calendar for. And let's see, that is happening at the Neil Simon on previews beginning February 10th, opening March 6th for a limited engagement.
So also we have Violet coming in that we didn't talk about last week. Was it, I don't know if it was before or after we recorded last week, but that that Sutton Foster's coming back to Broadway with Violet at Roundabout. And Amy, what's her name? Sherman Palladino, who is one of the creators of Bunheads, is financing it. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens there. Violet has always been back and forth. It's going to be on Broadway. It's not going to be on Broadway. Michael, was it Melissa Errico was rumored once to be thinking about taking Violet to Broadway, or did I forget?
Really? Wow, I never heard that.
I could be totally wrong about that, but I thought that Melissa Errico was going to do that once. So,
I did not see the original production of Violet, but they did a couple of, not too many years ago, Playwrights Horizons did a season of like mini revivals of shows that started there, and that was one of them. And so it was Lauren Ward, who we recently saw in Matilda, got to recreate her role, the title role in that production. And that was the first time actually I'd seen the show, and I really didn't know it before that. I'm not even sure I had the album. It's a wonderful, really beautiful show with music by Janine Tesori, who is she's having a wonderful moment now, because she just had she currently has Fun Home at the Public, which has received incredible acclaim. And there's talk that maybe that might come to Broadway as well. I hope they don't cancel each other out if they do in terms of awards and stuff. But anyway, we'll worry about that when it happens. It's a beautiful show.
And, you know, there seem to be opening this just in enough time for the Tony Awards and throw Sutton into the mix there. That'll be fun to see what happens there. I'm looking forward to it because I like to the productions of Violet that I've seen in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's a wonderful thing. It sounds great. And she is a perfect example of someone, Sutton Foster, who really has become a star primarily through her theater work. She has apparently a really tremendous fan base, and deservedly so. And I guess, you know, it doesn't hurt that she had bunheads. You know, I mean, obviously television is great exposure, and maybe that prompted people to check out her other work, her theater work as well. But she, and this we should say, Violet was also done, and I did not get to see this, but they did a one-nighter just this past summer, right? At Encores, as a kind of special event. And I guess that was maybe a kind of a test for this, for this Broadway run. But that was very well received. So that led to this. I'm sure that was really a good idea that they did that, because now it's going to be on Broadway at the American Airlines Theater in a roundabout production. And apparently, if I recall, this entailed the postponement or indefinite postponement of a revival of The Real Thing that they had announced with Ewan McGregor. So they really want to do this show, clearly. And as you said, James, it has that money behind it, that Hollywood money. So we will see what happens. I wish it the best.
To have something so recently as a month ago being announced suddenly stopped in its tracks. I wonder if Ewan McGregor got a film or something like that, or if something else happened there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll never know, but I think they just really wanted to do Violet with Sutton Foster.
Yeah,
and with that Hollywood money behind it.
Yeah, and certainly it seemingly is a really smart move. So we'll have to see what happens there.
But I do hope we get to see Ewan McGregor in the real. I love Ewan McGregor.
Yeah,
I think he's a really wonderful actor.
So
funny story. I just wanted to correct something. I misspoke last week, and I think you'll find it humorous. I think you'll understand why I misspoke. We were talking about Jane Carr, the wonderful Jane Carr, who is in A Gentleman's Guide to Murder. And I mentioned that what I said was that I saw her in a show called A Small Family Business with Angela Lansbury, but I was incorrect. A Small Family Business was a play that ran in 1992 with Jane Carr and Brian Murray, Amelia Campbell, Patricia Connolly, a lot of other wonderful people, but not Angela Lansbury. The show I was thinking of was a play that ran very briefly in 1982, and it was called A Little Family Business.
Ah.
With Angela Lansbury and John McMartin and Hallie Foote and a lot of other wonderful people in that too. So I hope you'll forgive me for that that confusion of A Little Family Business and A Small Family Business.
No, we cannot forgive you for that.
Jane Carr is fabulous either way. She's really great.
All right, so I think that wraps it up for this week. Michael, anything else you want to add before we get going?
Briefly, I saw a wonderful cabaret show called Rat Pack Poet, a tribute to the lyrics of Sammy Kahn and all the wonderful composers that he wrote to at the Triad. This is Eric Comstock and his incredibly talented wife, Barbara Fasano, with their special guest, Jeff Harnar. And I highly recommend that. The Triad is yet another great night spot, nightclub in Manhattan that if it's not on your radar, check it out, because they do some really wonderful things, including, as I mentioned earlier, that is where Disaster was first done. So you never know, you know, where you're going to find something amazing that then, you know, goes on to even greater things. Coming up, as I mentioned, we have Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, their Gypsy of the Year. So if you're free on Monday the 9th of December or Tuesday the 10th, you really might want to check that out. It's for a great cause, and Seth, I'm sure, will be happy to see you if you want to stick around afterwards and say hi to him.
So, Michael, I was looking up the Triad website, and they it says that they're transitioning to a new name called Stage 72. Do you know anything about that?
I remember I heard that. They've actually undergone several metamorphoses over the years. I think the first time I knew it was called Steve McGraw's.
Yeah.
I think it was Steve McGraw's when Forbidden Broadway first started there, and then continued. Forbidden Broadway continued after it was the Triad, I think. But they also are. I think they're struggling like a lot of other places like that for whatever reason. It's not easy. To run places like that and any level of nightclub, whether it be 54 Below or Feinstein's, and keep it profitable. It's just, I guess, the business model. I don't profess to understand really exactly why, but it's not always that easy to keep these places running, but they definitely deserve your patronage. The Metropolitan Room is another one. They all have great staffs. They're very helpful, and you can see amazing talent there for relatively small amounts of money compared to what you are paying these days on Broadway. So really, really, please keep them in mind.
Sure. The new website, stage72.com, STAGE, it's number 72.com. It's a nice website. All right. I'll put that in the show notes. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us another way, you can listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com. That way you can touch base with us and let us know if you have any comments or suggestions.
Well, we just hope everybody had a great Thanksgiving and
looking
forward
absolutely.
To, you know, nice end-of-the-year holidays for everyone.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me. That was a great turkey day as well.
Did yes, and apparently historic because it's the first time in how many years that the first day of Hanukkah and Thanksgiving fell on the same day. So,
oh, Michael, I'm so tangentially to that. Did you hear about this thing with the kinky boots and the Thanksgiving Day parade?
Yeah,
It seems as though that we feel that we've come so far, and we get occasionally reminded that there are idiots out in the world.
Some parents apparently feeling that how am I going to explain a drag queen to my child? Well, you know,
it was inappropriate to have kinky boots in the Thanksgiving Day parade at Macy's, and. I just don't even know what to say with people like this, but thankfully it seems that there are this is a diminishing voice that is out there that is very close-minded and can't understand that people are all different. And
I certainly hope so.
So, but it was really wonderful to see the it was an outrage on Facebook and Twitter, and so many people jumped in and really tried to come to the defense of kinky boots and I was just stunned about it. You know, it just I guess you think that we've come so far, but then you're reminded that we still have a long way to go.
I know. To end on a happier note, I should also mention I saw Frozen yesterday. Have you?
Oh, I saw Frozen yesterday too. I was
talking about it
on another podcast. But hey, if you're a listener out there that has seen Frozen, please drop us some of your thoughts on Frozen, because we're going to talk about it. I want to see if we can get somebody on the podcast who that was associated with the production.
That would be great. I mean, we had Jonathan Groff
maybe
like 2 years ago on the podcast. It was so wonderful to see and hear him have such a huge, wonderful part in it. And you know, obviously, Idina Menzel and then also Santino Fontana.
Yeah. And so
Idina's
down in D.C. right now doing If Then and getting pretty good reviews down there. And everybody's looking forward to that. So I wonder if If it's possible, I have to check and see if I can touch base with Idean and see if she's available to come on, because
we should say the score is by Bobby Lopez,
yeah,
and his wife, Bobby Lopez, whom we know as the co-writer of Avenue Q and Book of Mormon. But now he actually wrote the really great songs in this movie with his wife.
Yeah.
Just so it's got theater all over it. It's really fantastic.
Yeah, I saw it yesterday with my wife and kids, and we walked out, and my wife said, "Oh, that's ready to step right onto a Broadway stage, isn't it?"
Yes, and it even starts with a male chorus singing. Yeah. When's the last time you heard that? Probably in The Little Mermaid. You know, incredible.
All right, so we have lots of things to talk about in the future, and let's try to get something for Frozen on in the next few weeks. It's kind of crazy between Thanksgiving and Christmas to get anybody on, but we'll see what we can do. All right, so on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, who I think is returning next week, we'll have to see how his show is doing in rehearsal. This is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Tonight.